Sure is good to see everybody. We have a couple of visitors with us. We're glad that you can be with us to study God's Word. We're in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I'd invite you to turn your Bibles there. And we'll be looking at the first half or so of this chapter. 1 Corinthians is a great book. The Apostle Paul is dealing with Christians that are like Christians all over the place. They have problems, and he's encouraging them in things that are good and trying to discourage them in things that they're doing that are not good, trying to direct their ways in ways that are right. As we look at our outline of 1 Corinthians, that first section, you know, has to do with unity based on God's wisdom. There were divisions in Corinth that shouldn't have been, and Paul tries to get folks there to see that, you know, they're thinking too much in human terms and using human wisdom to consider their problems. And so he tries to get them back to the wisdom of God and divesting themselves of personal interests and human wisdom and all of that sort of thing. And then there are some sins in the church that need to be dealt with, some problems. He deals with how to deal with that immoral person in 1 Corinthians 5. He talks about those that are filing lawsuits in chapter 6 and the problem of sexual immorality later in chapter 6. And that sort of leads us in to chapter 7. Chapter 7, as we'll see in just a second, really begins the second large section. If you divide Corinthians up into two big sections, that this first section through chapter 6, Paul's dealing with things that were reported to him that he needs to deal with in the Corinthian church, that he's heard from others about what's going on there. And then apparently somebody in Corinth, or maybe some bodies in Corinth, wrote him a letter asking him some questions about things. And he deals with those in the last half of the book. So we're starting that section this morning, and we'll see that more in just a minute. We'll be looking at marriage problems and issues for singles in chapter 7, as well as some other instructions that Paul has to people in general regarding their relationships as they come into the kingdom. We'll talk about that in the next lesson at the end of chapter 7. So this morning, let's look into chapter 7, again, dealing first with marital relations, their sanctity, and the importance of each partner in a marriage surrendering themselves fully to the other. Again, the text starts here in verse 1, concerning the things of which you wrote to me. The things of which you wrote to me. So he had received some correspondence from them that we don't have, obviously. We don't know who exactly wrote it. It may have been written on behalf of the entire Corinthian church. That seems likely, by somebody or somebody's there. But they've written to him questions or concerns that they have. And so he addresses those, it seems like, throughout the remainder of the book. He'll start a section from now on by saying, now concerning. And so he starts this, now concerning the things of which you wrote, chapter 7 and verse 1. In verse 25, he says, now concerning virgins. In chapter 8 and verse 1, now concerning things sacrificed to idols. In chapter 12 and verse 1, now concerning spiritual gifts. And in chapter 16 and verse 1, now concerning the collection for the saints. Most scholars believe the way that language is used, and considering the way it's used there in chapter 7 and verse 1, probably each one of those phrases where it says now concerning, he's introducing something else that they wrote about. He's answering something else that they wrote about in that particular section, that they are saying, we need help with this, help us understand this, or whatever. So, again, back to chapter 7 and verse 1, concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Marriage is an honorable thing. It is most honorable. Back in Genesis 2, God created man for the woman. A woman for the man, I should say. I got that backwards. God created the woman for the man. He said, concerning the man, it is not good that man should be alone. You remember that? And therefore, it is good, the opposite would be, that man would have a companion for life that God created for him, the woman. So, in light of that, this statement of Paul's here might seem a little bit puzzling to us. What does he mean? It is good for a man not to touch a woman, being that marriage is honorable. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, marriage is honorable among all, the bed undefiled. So, you know, marriage is a good thing. The relationship between a man and a woman in the marriage is a holy thing. It is a good thing. It's compared to the relationship between Christ and the church in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 22, where wives are told to submit to their own husbands as to the Lord. The husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. He's the Savior of the body. And this metaphor, figure of speech, where Christ and the church are likened to a husband and wife and the beauty of the marriage relationship, that's carried through in a number of passages in the New Testament. So it kind of does bring this question, what does he mean? It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now let's think first of all about the context. You just studied the last class period, the last part of 1 Corinthians 6. What was the issue in 1 Corinthians 6, that last half, that Paul was dealing with? It's fornication or sexual immorality, right? So you have to remember, of course, these chapters and verses were added by men. And if you just read this, the flow of it would make a whole lot more sense connecting it to the previous discussion, where the concern was sexual immorality. So in view of that, you know, if you're thinking about sexual immorality, well, it's really good for a man not to touch a woman. So that's maybe part of what's included here. So the past discussion, when you get to this sort of hinge point right here, this makes a lot of sense in light of the past discussion. But it also makes a lot of sense going forward into the discussion in 1 Corinthians 7. This is why it's so good, so important, folks, to look at a phrase or a passage in its context. If we don't understand it in its context, we don't understand it. Now, it may have broader applications somewhere else, but you have to look at everything that surrounds it in its context. And I think that really helps us here with this particular phrase. Think about Paul's reasoning. And again, this is stuff we're going to get into as we go on in this context. But if you look at chapter 7 and verse 6, when he's talking about the man and the woman, the husband and wife, you know, not having relations for a short time, that they might give themselves to prayer and fasting. He says that could be done, but he says, I say this as a concession and not as a commandment. So it sounds like in that text, just the next few verses, what he's going to really say is, in the marriage relationship, it is good for a man to touch a woman. It is something that, in fact, it's something that you don't want to not do, something that you don't want to, you know, keep one another from doing. So in that relationship, he's pretty clear about that, isn't he? Still, that kind of leaves open this question, what other sense could it be said that it's good for a man not to touch a woman? Well, we get down to verse 26, and we're not going to get to studying this section until the next class period. But I just want to leap ahead a little bit and look at, for context's sake. He says, I suppose, therefore, that this is good because of the present distress, that is, it is good for a man to remain as he is. So there's some sort of present distress. Again, we'll study it more next class period. There's some sort of issue going on that might be temporary regarding, and apparently was temporary, regarding the kinds of stresses and strains that were being placed on marriage, probably having to do with persecution, where somebody might come in and say, you know, if you don't deny the Lord, I'm going to beat your husband up or kill your wife or whatever it might be, things like that, that might be going on. Again, we'll discuss that more next time. Look at verses 32 and 33. He says, I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. He who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. So there are really two things that Paul says that might account for him saying it might be good for a man not to touch a woman. The first is they're under a distress. He calls it a present distress, whatever the current issue was, probably some kind of persecution, that might make it easier to be a Christian if you weren't married. Okay, that's one. The other thing is, if you were married or are married, you might be more focused on the needs of your spouse rather than serving the Lord as you are. Again, he's going to elaborate on that more fully, but I think those things together sort of explain this statement that is made. The other thing I'll say about that statement, and then we'll move on, take your comments and questions about it if you'd like. It's very likely that somebody or bodies in Corinth was saying this. Now, Paul does not put, you know, in Greek there are not quotation marks. And sometimes it's difficult to tell if somebody's being quoted unless the text just says so-and-so said. Okay? But where he says, you know, he says, concerning the things that you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. This may be something that they literally put in their letter. You know, some people are saying, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. What do you say about that? You know, is that accurate? Is there some sense in which that's true? So Paul is saying, well, yeah, there could be some sense in which that's true. But when it comes to the marriage relationship, it's not true. Okay, so that's kind of where he goes with it as we get on into the next few verses. So anybody else have a question or thought there as I kind of rambled around and tried to look at various aspects of that? All right, I must be doing better than I think I am. Look at verse 2 with me. And he says, nevertheless, so he's sort of responding to himself or to the person that wrote in the letter, you know, good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, likewise also the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But this I say as concession and not as a commandment. For I wish that all men were even as I am, as I myself. But each one has his own gift from God, one this manner and another in that. So husbands and wives are to mutually surrender themselves. He says because of sexual immorality, fornication. Obviously, marriage is a defense against sexual immorality. If a human being has a holy outlet for their desire for the opposite sex, that's obviously much preferable to an unholy one. And here God has provided that in the context of marriage. And so that's why it is important for people to have their own husbands and wives, again, as a defense against sexual immorality. I think we all understand that principle. And because of that principle, then, in a marriage, husbands and wives have a responsibility to surrender themselves physically to one another. In fact, to regard the other person as having the control, the authority over their body, rather than themselves. And it's in this case, it's a mutual surrender of one another in order to have the needs of your partner met so that they're not tempted outside of the marriage relationship into something that would not be pleasing to God, as Paul has talked about at the end of chapter 6. So all of this then, again, goes together. Here's God, the God-given defense, or one of them, against sexual immorality, the union of the man and woman in marriage. And throughout Scripture, as we've already noted, Hebrews chapter 13 and other places, this is regarded as a holy thing, a beautiful thing, but also a thing that God has designed to meet the needs of the man and the woman. Depriving one another in this relationship is just forbidden. You're just not to do that. And, you know, with the way that the world today looks at the relationship, the physical relationship between men and women, and the way that that's been perverted and misused in so many different ways in our culture and our society, Christians need to be very careful not to bring that kind of stuff into a marriage. But the sexual relationship is not, you know, something that you use for blackmail. It's not something that you use to get your way. It's that kind of thing needs to be kept out of it altogether. You don't have authority over yourself. Your partner does. And you're not to deprive. That's a command. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time. So if you agree, well, we need to spend some time fasting or praying, or there's something going on here that needs a spiritual focus for a period of time, then that's fine if both the husband and wife consent to that or agree to that, that you would abstain for a period of time. But apparently not for a long period of time. Give yourself to fasting and prayer, but come back together again. And again, the purpose for coming back together is so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Again, I think we're all understanding what the apostle is telling us here. Now, what's kind of fascinating to me is that even this, Paul will say in the next verse, is not given by way of commandment. In other words, he says the rule is just don't deprive each other for any reason, you know, that you have control over. I recognize, you know, if you're in a coma in a hospital bed, you can't, you know, you're not going to be able to be with your spouse. But and we understand that sort of thing. But he said don't deprive your partner basically for any, you know, reason that you have control of. Except for this one thing, if you both agree to it. But even that, he says, I'm not saying you have to even do that. If you don't want to, if you just don't think it would be good for you because you'll experience temptation or you'll have problems, if you don't think it would be good for you to, you know, devote a period of abstinence so that you could pray and fast, if that's not, you don't have to do that. So he says, the way he puts it is, I say this as a concession and not as a commandment. So here's a reason that God would permit you not to have, you know, relations with your spouse. But even that reason is not saying you have to do that. Just saying it's a concession. You may, if you both agree, in other words. No, that's a great point, and we're going to see not only here, but especially if I get there. I hope I do. I need to hurry on. And that when we get a few verses on, this particular section has been truly abused by Christians who just want to separate from their spouses for no good reasons. And I think we're going to notice some things about that momentarily. Yes, go ahead, Paul. Yes, it is. It is misused, particularly by the Catholics. No, you're not. That's not the question you're asking. But so let me get back to your question. Mike's question is this a proof text for showing that monogamy is right and not polygamy? And the answer to that is yes. And I believe it's an appropriate one to use for that purpose. To get to the bottom line there, let each man have his own wife and each woman have her own husband. Singular. You know, not man have his own wives, plural. So, you know, it's not a harem situation. It's not polygamy that's being described here. It's one-to-one. And I think very clearly that the spouses belong to one another exclusively. It's what's being described there. What I thought Mike was asking was about the Catholic belief that because of Paul's statement in at the end of verse 1 that celibacy is better than marriage, and that's not what's being said there, as we've already kind of noted that. All right. Good questions and good comments. Appreciate them. Paul wishes that all people had his gift to live celibate without excessive stress or temptation. He recognizes that all do not. Paul was a single man. He was able to do that, I think, without overmuch stress and temptation. There are some things that some people just aren't tempted with much. You know, I can see that in my own life. I've never really been tempted to drink, for instance. Some people just can't hardly seem to look at alcohol without being tempted. I've never had any temptation whatsoever along that line. So there are some things that people, you know, some people have trouble with and others don't. Well, Paul apparently didn't have trouble with sexual temptation. And that was, he calls it a gift. And indeed it would be. But that's unusual, I think, among men. And he recognized that all certainly do not have that. And so he certainly understands and is encouraging people to get married and to fulfill their marriage obligations for their spiritual good. In verse 8, then, he says, I say to the unmarried and to widows, it is good for them to remain even as I am. And here again, that might raise a question in our minds. You know, in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 14, Paul says, I desire therefore that the younger widows do what? Marry. Okay. So how does this, you know, how do we reconcile these two statements? Well, again, going back to the things we've already talked about, in the context of what he's writing to 1 Corinthians, there was a present distress, probably some kind of persecution that was going on. The very verses that we looked at a minute ago, verse 26, verses 32 and 33, sort of explain this in this context. He's not saying, you know, widows and unmarried don't get married. He's just saying it would be good if they could remain as I am, if they had the same gift that I have. I think that's implied from the previous verse, if they can do that without temptation. And then also considering the present distress and those kinds of things that we've already talked about. Younger widows, the general rule would be still 1 Timothy 5:14, need to remarry. It says, you know, bear children, manage the house, give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully. So then we have in verse 9, sort of Paul saying that if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry. It is better to marry than to burn with passion. And of course, that would be more of a difficulty for a younger person than for an older person. And that goes very well along with what he says in 1 Timothy chapter 5. So that gets us into this instructions for the married section here, which can generate quite a bit of controversy and has over the years. And I need to hurry through it, but it's important that we cover this carefully. Let me just read starting in verse 10. Now to the married I command, yet not I but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. So what Paul is saying here is in essence the same thing Christ said when he was on the earth. That's what he's meaning to say. He's saying it, but, you know, Christ really already said this in the instructions that Jesus gave in Matthew chapter 5, 32, in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 6, in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9. Basically, you know, remember in Matthew 19, the Pharisees come and ask, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? And the bottom line answer to that, what God has joined together, let not man separate. Divorce is not the will of God generally. In 19:9, he gives one reason that would allow for it. Okay, and that is having to do with sexual immorality. Your spouse has been unfaithful. So he says, again, to the married I command, yet not I but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. The word depart there would include divorce, but doesn't necessarily require it. It's a word that really literally means to separate. It's the same word that's found in Matthew 19 and verse 6. Let not man put asunder or separate. Okay, so same word in the original Greek is used here in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 10. She's not to depart. You got that? If she does depart, she is to either remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. Now, I'll just tell you, here's a place where a lot of brethren try to justify separation and say it's okay. I don't understand how people think, but I'm going to tell you what. Paul just said, don't depart. And he's not going to turn around in the next verse and say, oh, it's okay if you depart. Come on, you know, we have to think more clearly than that. He just said, don't depart. If you do depart, I think what he's saying is, don't make matters worse. If you remarry and you don't have the right to do that, you're in adultery. So he says, either remain unmarried, or the preferable option would be what? Be reconciled to your husband. Go back to your husband. Now, there are other passages where this kind of language is used. And in those passages, talking about other things, but it's a situation where don't do this, but if you do this, don't make matters worse. That's not permitting them to go ahead and do it. You see the first thing? Let me show you what I mean. Look at Galatians chapter 5 and verse 14. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 14. All the law is fulfilled in one word, even this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Okay, so that's what we're supposed to be doing. Love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, well, if we bite and devour one another, we're not loving our neighbor as ourself, are we? So we violated that command. He says, if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. So, you know, you decide you're not going to love your neighbor. You're biting and devouring one another. It's okay as long as you don't consume each other, right? You can go ahead and do that. Is that what he's saying? Nobody believes that. He's just told them not to do it. He just said, you know, and then so you violate that law. So it's go ahead. And as long as you don't violate the next one, you're okay. That's not the way that language is used. And even maybe more clearly, if you look at James chapter 3, verses 13 and 14. James chapter 3, verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in meekness of wisdom. So you need to be meek. You need to show that your works are done in meekness of wisdom by your conduct. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, so you violated that first command. You know, you're not meek, you're self-seeking. Just do not boast and lie against the truth. You know, so after you violate that first command, you're okay. You're really okay there, just as long as you don't go do this next thing. Again, applying the same logic back to 1 Corinthians 7, Paul's saying, he says it repeatedly, actually, do not depart, do not depart, do not depart in this context. And then to turn around and say, but it's really okay if you depart, and that's not a sin, is really doing an injustice to this context overall. So, to the thing that the Lord said, basically the rule that he laid down in the Gospels, is don't depart. Don't put your marriage asunder. Don't separate. But verse 11, back in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. Husband is not to divorce his wife. But he says, to the rest I say, not the Lord. Now, who are the rest? Well, the rest apparently are those who are believers who are married to unbelievers. See, only believers would be under or feel like that they're under the authority of Christ and be supposed to follow what Christ said to do. But if you have a believer who's married to an unbeliever, well, the unbeliever is not going to do what Christ said to do. We understand that. He should, but he's not, doesn't feel like he's under the authority of Christ. So here you've got a different situation, and Christ really wasn't addressing two non-disciples or two non-believers in Matthew chapter 19. That is assuming, what he assumes in Matthew 19 is that both would be amenable to doing what he said to do. But as Christ commanded, one who is married is not to leave his or her spouse. But now Paul is addressing one who is married, a believer to an unbeliever. And what he says is, let's go and read this quickly. To the rest I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe, she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving wife is the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? So what we have in verses 12 through 14, Paul is basically saying that the believer is not to end the relationship if the unbeliever is willing to dwell together. So if you're a believer, you're married to an unbeliever, and the unbeliever is willing to live with you, you are not to separate from them, you're not to divorce them. All right, that's, I think, pretty clear in verses 12 through 14. In a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever, the thing is, both partners in a marriage are joined by God, what God has joined together, right? And so if it's, you know, if there are people who are marriageable under God's law, and they've been joined together, that is holy matrimony. It's what we call it, and that's a good, not strict Bible word, but that's marriage is holy and honorable, and that is what that is. So with respect to the marriage itself, the marriage is a holy marriage. Y'all following that? A lot of people look at this word holy here, and it gets confusing because he talks about the unbelieving husband sanctified by the wife, the unbelieving wife sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. And if you're thinking sanctification in the terms of cleansing from sin, being saved, no, you're not saved just because you marry a Christian or are married to a Christian. That's not what he's saying. What he's talking about with respect to the marriage. You have to look at the context. With respect to the marriage covenant, you're good. It's a holy marriage, and you are holy in that marriage. Even though you may not be a Christian and holy in the sense of saved and purified by the blood of Christ, in this marriage relationship, that's holy. That's what he's talking about. And so the children that you have in such a relationship are, you know, if your marriage wasn't holy, then the children would be unholy. We would say illegitimate. They would not be proper children of, you know, one of the parents. But nobody looks at it that way. God doesn't look at it that way. A Christian's married to a non-Christian, those children are legitimate in that marriage, I believe is what he's saying. A lot of different viewpoints of this, I think, and as I said, controversies about it. But hopefully y'all are kind of following what I'm saying. Y'all have a question or thought about it you'd like to add to what I've said? Anybody? Okay. Let's move on and look at this. Yeah, Lindsay, sorry. That's what I'm going to. So, next verse. She's asking, what is the bondage? If the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. God has called us to peace. So, the believer is left by the unbeliever. Suppose that occurs. If the unbeliever leaves, the believer is not under bondage. I believe the bondage there is the bondage to fulfill their spousal duties. He's talked already in this context about spousal duties, like surrendering your body to your partner, you know, earlier in the chapter. Well, if your unbelieving spouse leaves, you don't have to follow them all the way across the country to fulfill your obligation as a wife or a husband. The word bondage there, and this is an important thing to note, bondage in this verse is the obligation of duty. It is not the same concept as the marriage bond. two different words in the Greek language, entirely two different concepts. The idea of bondage is that of service that you offer. That's the meaning of the word. You're bound to offer this service, okay? So you could think of a slave. Actually, the same word is used for slavery. So you're bound as a sense of duty to do something, okay? Later on in this chapter, in chapter 7 and verse 27, are you bound to a wife? That's an entirely different word. That's the word that's used like over in Matthew, where two become one, you're joined together. It has to do with the idea of, you know, you take two sticks and you tie them together in one. So the concept of the marriage bond, two becoming one, is found in this text, but it's in chapter 7, later on there in verse 27. So again, the bondage in 15, that the believer is not under bondage. They don't have to do what a spouse is supposed to do anymore. They're not obligated to that service, is, I believe, certainly what Paul is saying. And, you know, he doesn't want the believer to have to fret about all of that. Well, you know, my husband has left me, or my wife has left me because they don't want to live with a believer, and now am I supposed to be still, I've got obligations. They're still my wife. They're still my husband. Do I have to, you know, go clean their house for them or whatever? And Paul's answer is no, you don't have to do that spousal service anymore. You don't have to do that. And don't worry about it. And he says, God has called us to peace. Just be at peace with it. It's okay. It's okay. God has called us to peace. You don't have to do that. So he gets to this point in verse 16. What he's encouraging the believers to do is, if it's possible, to stay married to that unbeliever. If they'll stay with you, you stay with them. And the main reason that he's going to give for that is found elsewhere in Scripture as well, and that is, how many times have we seen, you know, this relation, this thing where a believer is married to an unbeliever, and of course the unbeliever can influence the believer. We've seen that a good bit as well, but many times we've seen the believing spouse, bring the unbeliever to Christ. If they'll stay strong, if they'll live the kind of life that God wants them to live, they can bring that happen. It's happened in my family. My grandmother brought my grandfather to Christ in that way. You've seen it probably in many of your families, where a believer is married to an unbeliever and it winds up that the unbeliever becomes a Christian. And so, you know, you don't know if that's going to happen or not. So don't just give up on your marriage because you believe and your spouse doesn't. You know, I've seen, usually it's a woman who's a Christian and suffer all sorts of abuse from a husband who doesn't want her to go to church, who doesn't want her to be a Christian and all of that. But she'll patiently endure it over the years and continue to live a chaste and godly life. And eventually that man comes around. I can think of two men in the last congregation that I worked with that's the case. Right now they're Christians because their wives were Christians and were patient with them over the years. And that's exactly what Peter describes there in 1 Peter 3, isn't it? 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1. Likewise, wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. So don't give up on your marriage if you're married to an unbeliever. Continue to serve the Lord with faithfulness and live a virtuous life before your spouse. And who knows whether you'll save them. God's not guaranteeing that you will, but you have that opportunity here. Right. whereas, I think that's that may be implied. I'm not sure that that's the case, but I do understand what you're saying. I think what Gary's saying is, you know, even if the unbeliever departs, if that believer continues to remain unmarried, as the earlier instruction was, to live that godly life, you know, that unbeliever may eventually kind of come back around and say, wow, my spouse is still holding on to this. You know, my life has been terrible since I left. And maybe we do need to be reconciled, and maybe I do need to consider becoming a Christian. That kind of thing could happen. It could. Yeah, it could fall into that. I agree with that. That's a possibility. Good thought. Good thought. All right. Well, it's not the easiest passage in the world, and a lot of folks have been, I think, confused about it, but hopefully that'll help us with a basic understanding of it. We're going to go on to even more difficult ground, I think, in the next lesson, in the end of chapter 7, the rest of chapter 7. So I encourage you to read and study that for next time. Thanks for your help this morning.